Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And today we have back, by popular demand, Dr. Lee Haynes, who is a professor of medical entomology here at the University of Notre Dame. So welcome back, Lee.
Hello. And hello, listeners.
We are very excited to have you here. You have been very gracious in sharing our podcast with friends and family and colleagues, which has helped spread this wide, so we are grateful for that. But then your episode is just a favorite of many people.
Including us.
Yeah, yes. Including us, both yeah. As experiencing recording it and then listening to it back. And so we're very excited to have you again to talk more.
I'm delighted to be back.
Cool. Well, even though we asked you this the first time you're here, that was a while ago, so we're going to ask it again. Are you currently listening to, reading, or watching anything interesting that you want to share with us?
Always.
Yes.
Always. I've just finished reading a book by Percival Everett. Mm-hmm. It's called James.
Okay.
It is a different spin on Huckleberry Finn.
Mm.
Very interesting book about the slave trade and eye-opening and beautifully written. So I recommend that for reading. And while balancing the horrors of that, I was also reading Oliver Millman's book called The Insect Crisis, which is equally as disturbing from an insect perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, heavy, heavy books. So I balanced that off by watching what I thought was going to be less heavy, which is Adolescence.
Oh.
It's a new Netflix film. And for me, I was really excited because it's Stephen Graham.
Yes.
And it's Liverpool.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, my beloved Liverpool.
And then
it is heavy.
Yeah.
So my diet so far has been heavy. So this podcast is my lightness. So
wonderful.
Thank you.
Of course. Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. I have spoken to Shahir about that show, Adolescence, which I think no matter what, I'm happy to give it a plug on this show. I think it's a really important piece of television.
It is.
For anybody to watch, but I have teenage boys. You have teenage boys.
I do, yes.
And you have not watched it yet.
I have not finished it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, heavy, but really important. So,
and brilliant acting.
Unbelievable acting. Unbelievable directorial techniques. It's all, every episode is filmed in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as much as we like to talk about science, people should go consume good art as well.
For sure.
So,
yes.
Go do that and then check out those books as well. So I do have a question, actually, because I was thinking about this today. How do you find time to read things that aren't? Maybe that's a bit of a facetious question, but
so
I have a stack of books and I'm just having a hard time finding the time to step away from work and read them and consume that type of art.
It is a struggle for me. One of the things I did was joined a book club, which forces me to read. So James was the topic of last month. So I did read it and I made a point of reading it. But I found that carrying the book with me and not doing it Kindle or having an audiobook is the way to go. Because then when you're waiting for, I don't know, a vaccine or in lineup for something, I'm like, yep, there's the book. Okay, I have no excuse for not listening to it or reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has helped tremendously. Waiting, because we spend most of our lives waiting for something, waiting for an experiment, waiting for someone to show up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like fitting it into our already chaotic lives, because trying to block off time to read is difficult, and I usually would like to do it at night, but when it's heavy material or really exciting material, trying to go to sleep is compromised, so I try to intersperse it with my day a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, I've tried audiobooks. Sometimes I space out, like, listening to a podcast, I feel like I'm a little bit more engaged. Audiobooks, I'm like, oops, I totally have lost where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's good advice. I've been thinking a lot about waiting. Like, we used to just wait all the time before phones and everything. And
carry it with you because it's tactile.
Yeah.
And there's something, for me, hypnotic about the sound of a page turning.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't noticed that, make a point of noticing
it.
Because it's this beautiful sound and you're getting your fingers touching it, and it's not just visual. Remember last time I talked about our reliance on vision?
Yes.
So this is a way to enrich your experience by holding it and turning it and smelling the books. Some books smell amazing. Others are colonized by an interesting bacteria. That's the smell of an old library. So you can get a lot more from that, the smell of the ink.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a whole sensory
thing. It is a sensory thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna do it. I have a book on my desk in the lab, and I just haven't opened it.
You know, I've tried the audiobooks and I think they're okay for just kind of getting the information. What I like to do sometimes is go back and reread certain parts. It's much harder with an audiobook to do that. Because you don't see where you are, so it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And you can't dog-ear the pages.
Underline things, quotes that you like. Yeah. They're much harder. So I do like the physical book.
Yeah. Do you think that reading these types of kind of, right, the insect book you were talking about obviously pertains a little bit more to your research, but some of these other things that really have no correlation to your research, do you find that they help you think differently? As a scientist?
Yes. How's that?
Perfect.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Next question.
I'm sorry. I'm throwing questions at you that aren't.
Because anything that brings understanding of our environment or of animals or of our neighbors will help us interact.
For sure.
And become better scientists, become better communicators, become more aware of our world. So no, I think I learn so many things from whatever books, even cartoons. How to communicate better.
Sure, sure. Okay, sorry, that was my little tangent off of that. And I know we have
a very nice tangent.
Other things.
It's a very important tangent, I think.
Well, I think there's just something like people who are able to read books, watch TV, that's not just kind of binge watching and engage. Tips and tricks to do that are helpful and can help you be more mindful about consuming things as well.
For sure.
So I like to ask people because I'm struggling to figure that out at this moment. I've done it in the past and now I'm like, I don't know, and I miss it and it's hard. So just having somebody's like, yeah, I do it. This is how I do it. And it's not perfect. It's not like I, you know, sit down and read for hours. Just it's helpful.
I want to say that something I do with a book, and I highly encourage you to do it as well, the listeners do this. When you finish reading a book, write in the very beginning your name, the date you finished, where you read it, and maybe a one-sentence snippet about something that struck you in the novel, and give it to somebody else, and tell them to do that. Mm. And over time, this book travels the world, you know, and
that's
sometimes
cool.
It comes back to you, or if you put your email address, sometimes somebody in Egypt will write to you and say, I have this book. I have no idea how it started, but your email address is on here. So I just want to say, hi, I'm really interested in knowing you or whatever. And it keeps the communication going long after you finish reading the book.
This is a lovely idea.
This is a lovely idea.
Keep it going.
All right.
Send it off. And sometimes it never comes back.
Right.
But sometimes it will surprise you. And it's like it becomes history itself. You're creating history with this book.
Yeah.
And you're disseminating it in an unusual way because you've recommended it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I try to buy all my books used or pick them up at, you know, random stores. And I remember I found a poetry book. And inside were all these notes and letters that the person had left for somebody. So this poem made me think of you, or like just little notes. And then these books do become stories of more than just the story in the book.
Yeah.
I love that. Okay, listeners, do that.
Do that.
And I hope I come across a book from some of you.
I'm tapping into a bit of my Canadian heritage there. Because have you heard of an Inukshuk?
No.
Have any of you heard of an Inukshuk? It means when the people were here, and it's you see these kind of human-like statues that are in the middle of nowhere built with rocks, and some can be really high, and they're in the Arctic, and they're on trails, and people just make them, and sometimes they're only the size of 2 inches, and other times it's like a huge statue. And it's a way to encourage you when the land is barren to see that somebody has been there before you, and it brings encouragement, and like, I'm not alone. And so using the book as mm-hmm. here. It's not just a book, but mm-hmm. I have pre-read it and mm-hmm. I have taken something from it and I want you to read it. Mm-hmm. It's like a literary Inukshuk in my head. And so I like doing that. And I love hearing when people notice something about the book that I didn't even pick up.
Right, right. So, all right, well,
do
when,
it.
When I finish the book that I have on my desk, I will pass it on to you next. If you haven't already read it, we'll see. But
no,
I'll pass it on.
Okay.
All right. I'll do that.
Do it.
Excellent. I think we're starting a whole new trend here.
I hope so.
This is great.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
All right. Traveling books.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I derailed. From the get-go, derailed.
This is great. This is exactly
this is typical.
What
this is. See what happens when you invite me onto this show.
Well, I think it does highlight scientists are more than the research that we do, and we can all learn from each other in all types of capacities.
Absolutely.
And sharing books is one of my favorites. I've shared so many books.
Yeah, I know. We've shared books together for many years.
Yeah, we have. And we would pass notes back and forth about them stuff. So,
So we kind of did that, but not with intention, really.
No,
but not
no.
in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is cool. I'm definitely going to do that.
I'm going to do it, too.
All right.
Okay, now we can...
Well,
I
have a question for you.
Okay.
And it's kind of... it's a little bit on the wild side. You know, I was looking up some of the work that you've done, and your work in parasitology seems to take you into wild places sometimes.
It does.
And one of those places is Knowsley Safari, which is near Liverpool in the UK.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe you're flagging this. Of all the things that I've done. Okay, continue.
And you worked on trying to understand the diseases in the monkey population that's there.
Mm-hmm.
What are monkeys doing in the UK? And tell us a little bit about this Knowsley Safari. What is it? And the kind of work that you're doing there. And tell us some crazy stories, because I feel like there's some crazy stories here.
There are. You have to make a decision. Do you want to hear a story about baboons or squirrels?
Baboons for sure.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Without a doubt.
Okay, so this was, this is a fantastic story. I'm glad you pulled this out.
Excellent.
So
I don't know the story, just FYI. I just looked up I looked up your publications, right? And this came up. And there's nothing about crazy baboon stories here.
No.
So I'm really curious.
All right, I'm settled in.
So many of you know that a pandemic hit the world in 2020.
Yes.
And at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, we have master's students that usually do field work and they go all over the world. But with the shutdown of air travel, we had to scramble and come up with some field projects so they learn skills, valuable skills of working in the field, which is very different than working in the lab. And fortunately, I was working with two professors at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, James LaCourse and Russell Stothard, who had thought that maybe we could tap into field work at a field station, which was local. So Knowsley Safari Park is very close to Liverpool, and it's a beautiful oasis for the animals. It was established in 1971, and it has, a lot of animals,
yes.
Many different species, and it's huge. It's 6.4 hectares.
Wow.
So it's a massive local field study site for the animals. And it's also a tourist attraction because you can drive through the park, and one of the places that you can drive through in your car, smart if you keep your windows closed, is a baboon enclosure. And so I don't know how much you know about all of baboons.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm. So there's 240 of them, roughly, there at the safari park. And they like to interact with the cars. And I use interact loosely because they like to destroy the cars.
Okay.
They'll pull off your windshield wipers and
of course.
This kind of thing.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting features, especially of the juvenile males, is to deposit their own paint on the cars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the form of fecal smearing.
I have two boys at home, so what you're describing of baboons is kind of like when they were very young. And
okay.
Still some of the traits are still there. Yeah. They're teenagers.
That's lovely, though.
Yeah, it's lovely. So
okay.
We're not so different from baboons,
no,
are we?
I think
okay.
That's the first takeaway. All right, continue with the story.
Yes. So the question was, what is the history on these baboons? Mm-hmm. They've been in the park for a very long time. They were inherited from one of the founders who had them in a circus. Mm-hmm. And then the population grew. But they were originally from an African country. And so you don't know the kind of parasites that they're carrying in their gut. You don't know if they're transmitting worms. You don't know anything because it hasn't been looked at before. So the troop is healthy. But what is in their poop?
Wonderful.
You know, we were talking about poop last time. How did we get it?
We talk about poop
wild
a lot.
Question.
We talk about poop a lot. We've talked about poop transplants before.
Everyone wants to know about poop, man. Yeah. We're all still children at heart.
We all poop.
And poop says so much about how healthy we are. So it makes sense that animals would be the same.
Yeah. It does.
Yeah.
So
research question here.
This was the question.
Yes.
What is infecting these baboons? And are they hosting, because they're so much like us, any human pathogens, human worms? So that means looking at fecal material to look for worm eggs and other indications of disease. So with a whole team of MSc students and a few faculty members and me who went along with this exercise, we monitored, I think it was 2,600 cars that went through, I think it was a 4-day cycle, through the park and took videos to see which baboons were pooping, what sexes they were. That's how we know it was mainly juvenile males. What time of the day they were more likely to poop on the cars, where they were, what part, like they really liked the roofs because they could jump on top.
Yeah. Sure.
Were there any cars that were a preference? Uh-huh. And it's usually the ones that are moving very slowly or had stopped. Uh-huh. And the frequency of the pooping usually followed a meal. So in the afternoon, they would decide to decorate the cars. Yeah. So all in all, once the cars were coming out of the enclosure, then the team would go and scrape off and get some nice clean poo samples, which is unusual for animals because normally it drops on the ground and you don't know if you're picking up contamination from the soil. Mm-hmm. So these were considered clean poop samples, which seems a bit like an oxymoron, no?
Yeah, yeah. So the cars, in a sense, were kind of the vials for the experiment.
Yes. So
how lovely.
Oh, how lovely indeed.
Okay.
Yes. So it was an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So then the students had to sift through all the poop. They had to culture the poop to see if any of the eggs hatched so that they can identify what worm species were there. And they found some interesting findings, and that was probably the research that was published in 2023. And the main finding, I think the one that was most important, was that many, I think it was 14%, much higher than we had thought, of the baboons, or maybe it's like 48%. I can't remember at the moment.
Yeah, that's a significant chunk.
A significant amount were infected with whipworm, which is a worm that also can infect humans.
Mm.
So the thought was, oh my goodness, you're going to go home with a dirty car and then you're going to wash your car. Your dog's going to eat that with an interesting thing on your car.
Yeah.
So does that pose a risk to the public? And it was really good to know that the potential was there. But because the poo hadn't dropped on the ground and it hadn't had time to be exposed to environmental conditions, the fecal material was not really infective, which is great. So if you washed your car, it was all good. But if it were to stay on there for a while and then you were to get it under your fingernails or something, then you put your fingernails in your mouth because it's a fecal oral transmission, the risk may be there. But it was so negligible that it was good to know that, okay, these baboons are infected. We need to get them treated, which is very difficult to do.
Yes.
You ever think about treating, deworming a baboon?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. How do you control the dose of the drug they're going to get?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a big thing. So that was the baboon story, and it was loads and loads of Petri dishes filled with culturing poo and all the hazards of working outdoors with the weather and then with people and with the baboons. And so it was a really good field experience for the students.
Did they ever throw poop at you also? Or they just do it on the cars?
So in the wild, and I've only witnessed this in Kenya, they will throw poo at you.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
If you make them very agitated.
Yeah.
So, no, we didn't see that. At least I didn't see that. Maybe some of the students noticed or some of the people in the cars driving. I don't know. But
science is fun, kids.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, I work in a traditional bench work lab, but doing field work, and honestly, collecting poop and seeing what's in it is one of my dream things to get to do someday.
I know a person.
I know.
Talk to.
But I just
that is a weird dream, Maggie.
I kind of want to ask you about this too. Again, I don't know if this is on the list of questions. Field work is just not something I've ever gotten to experience, and I love the idea of just being out and actually. So much of what we do in the lab is removed from the actual applications or what's actually happening. And we aren't a part of seeing the direct impact of our research when we're in a lab. But the ability to do field work and observe baboons and see they're pooping on cars and that poses as a risk to human health. And we can see the humans in the car, right? And getting to experience that side of science. And you do a little bit of both. I think currently you're not doing as much field work here at Notre Dame?
No, not yet.
Yeah. So can you, maybe just to continue my dream, talk a little about the differences in your experience with field work? What do you prefer? And what are the benefits of being in either of those situations as a researcher?
I like both.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're highly complementary. I would say what you learn the most in the field is how best to communicate. And it builds resilience, which is something that's difficult to build in a lab.
Mm-hmm.
It also forces you to rely on common sense. And I value that highly. And people that are able to work under extreme circumstances, power failures, things going missing, flat tires going out.
Weather.
Mm. The cooler doesn't cool anymore, so your samples melt in the heat you've got to start all over again.
Yeah.
Sickness, you drink some bad water or you get injured or you have an elephant destroy your traps.
Oh, no.
Or
these are all from personal experience.
They are. But it makes for great stories for podcasts. But it really makes you appreciate being alive.
Yeah.
You don't take it for granted.
Did you really have an elephant destroy your traps?
What? No, but I almost died with an elephant.
Oh, man.
So it was even worse than a trap.
Like,
and I'm not talking about that story
today. Okay, all right. Well, I'll have to save that for
so that for when you return.
Yeah, episode. So you could ask me, Meg, about my interaction with an elephant, an angry elephant, yes.
That's cool. Field work is really appealing to me, but as a doing more pathogenic microbiology work in humans, it's just not the type of thing that lends itself to any field work. So I'm kind of bummed.
You do field work with your ducks.
Yes.
Right? You go out, you monitor their health, you are aware of how food conversion is happening, you're looking to see if there's any vectors of disease flying around.
Right.
You are doing field work, just with a different species.
That's true. I guess that's part of my deep motivation to get ducks was to be able to participate.
How many ducks do you have now?
I still have 13.
13.
13.
And okay, that I won't tell your homeowners association. Hopefully they're not listening.
Hopefully not. I doubt it. Yeah, that's true. I do pay attention to their poop a lot.
Yeah.
And kind of keep track of who's healthy, who's not.
See?
What's worrisome behavior.
Whether you have mites.
Yes, keeping track of that, making sure water
and
is clean.
Predators.
Predators, yep.
We have quite a bit of predators around here.
Coming up with clever little tricks to keep things out and and currently getting a lot of duck eggs. So
there was my point. You are a good field scientist.
I have some duck eggs for you, Lee.
So. Oh, thank you.
All right. That's
This is wonderful.
I love hearing the field work story. I think it's super cool.
It is.
And
okay.
I'm jealous. All right.
So I want to kind of talk a little bit more about the research that you're doing.
Sure.
And one of the things that you're doing is, one of the strategies is that, you know, to fight the spread of diseases that are carried by insects is drug repurposing. What is drug repurposing? Can you tell us a little bit more about what that term means mm-hmm. and how it relates to your work on the tsetse flies and the diseases that they spread?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I will do this in a nutshell.
Okay.
So first of all, we have a big paper coming out that mm-hmm. is showcasing a drug we are working with called nitisinone, and it has been repurposed. And by repurposed, it means you look at a drug, it does X, but then you notice it also does Y, mm-hmm. and there might be a way to develop it further in that way, beyond a patent, for instance. Yeah. And then maybe you might find it does Z as well.
Wow.
So nitisinone was developed as a weed killer.
Yeah.
And it works by bleaching whatever plant it works on and shutting down the chlorophyll pathway, so mm-hmm. the plants die because they turn white. But it was too strong. Mm-hmm. So they took it off the pipeline for production. But it blocks an enzyme that's really important to most things, including humans. Mm-hmm. And so the brilliant toxicologist that was working with this herbicide mm-hmm. in that case noticed that it might be able to be repurposed for a human disease.
Yeah.
So his name is Ted Locke. And fortunately, he was based in Liverpool when I was there.
Wonderful.
So
yeah.
I was able to talk with him, and he published this tremendous paper called From Weed Killer to Wonder Drug.
Yeah.
And it's the story of nitisinone and how they were able to repurpose it to treat humans with a disease called tyrosinemia, mm-hmm. Type 1. And then now many other diseases are looking at using this drug, including, I think it's being investigated for Parkinson's as well and albinism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many different things. But what we noticed is that it blocks the activity of a very important enzyme in our bodies. And so with these people that had the drug or the diseases, the drug would block the accumulation of toxic things in their body.
Okay.
This pathway in blood-sucking insects mm-hmm. is crucial for their survival, but only when they drink blood. If they stay drinking sugar, they're safe.
Right.
So if we give nitisinone to them, whether they walk on it with their feet and they pick it up that way, or mm-hmm. you put it into the blood or the sugar, they die.
Wow.
So the poor insects die. Yeah. Terrible. So we are now repurposing it from a herbicide, from a human drug therapy, to now what we call a vector control tool to help control the populations of blood-sucking insects.
Yeah.
So this was the work from Marcus Sterkel, a colleague of ours who's now based in Argentina, and he came to Liverpool to work with us to use tsetse flies instead of kissing bugs.
Yeah.
Because the faster you digest, the more susceptible you are to dying.
Yes.
So tsetse flies digest blood very quickly. Every 48 hours.
Uh-huh.
They have to feed all the time, and they only feed on blood.
Yeah.
So it was a great system to test out this drug and figure out how much of it you would need to kill, and you need very tiny amounts of it.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
So it means you can utilize it for vector control. So this is the tsetse story, and it's similar. And the poor insects, they drink the blood, they get the shakes, then they can't walk anymore, they can't fly, they flip onto their backs, liquefy, and die.
Oh man!
Oh wow, that's gruesome.
It's gruesome.
It is gruesome.
But you ask me for gruesome stories. Oh, yes. On here.
That's true.
That's all we want.
I like that.
Yeah. So it works on all blood sucking creatures that we have tested and that other labs have tested. So it looks like a pan-specific scalpel that can be used to eliminate blood-sucking disease vectors. Mm. And this latest work that's coming out very soon is on mosquitoes. And we did the most amazing thing. We partnered as co-creators with patients, or not patients, people who have alkaptonuria, which is one of these diseases that use nitisinone as a therapy.
Right.
And they kindly donated some blood for us to feed to the mosquitoes to see if the dose of nitisinone that they were on, which is an ultra low dose, would still be mosquitocidal. And it was.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
We were very excited because it looks like this whole pathway of drug repurposing for vector control will work, is feasible. And the offshoot of this is nitisinone is a very expensive drug. So if we can find other ways to use it and mass produce it, it will drop the cost of the drug for anybody that's taking it as therapy. So it's a win-win. It's amazing.
Right.
So this is repurposing.
So how does a scientist go about saying this is a drug that we think will work for this? That's totally seemingly unrelated to either its original purpose, and in this case seems to be have been repurposed multiple times, right? Mm-hmm. From a biochemist standpoint, I can kind of understand how you would ration that, but how does that happen? Is it just kind of like, let's see if this one works, or how do they narrow it down to pick which drugs should be tried for these types of repurposing?
A lot of it is serendipity. Science is serendipity.
Yeah, this is true.
And I argue that serendipity doesn't happen unless you're paying attention and observing. Many times something great happens, you're like, I don't have time to pursue that. So it's either serendipity, but usually an informed mind is more likely to pick up on something that's different, like a different pattern. And if you're a biochemist and you understand the pathways that are being blocked and you know a little bit more about what the drug does, you might be able to predict that, hey, this weed killer might be used to help with this disease like tarrocinemia, like Ted Locke did. And he said, why don't we go for it? Why don't we try it? We need to get some trials in. And it really is a wonder drug. It has saved people's lives. They can go on. Not normally, but living much longer. They can have children. I mean, it really is a wonder drug. So it takes curiosity. It takes serendipity. It takes really understanding what you're working on. And for me, I think thinking big picture. Like, don't get caught into this silo of thinking of, oh, this is a herbicide. But what else can it do? This is my career. Yes, I'm a medical entomologist, but what else can I be doing?
That's wonderful.
Why narrow yourself down to one thing? Why narrow a drug down to one thing?
So first of all, congratulations on the work, because really
thank
cool. And it's, you know, big discoveries like this are very hard to come by. So
they're
a result of a lot of hard work. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. And this is such a really cool story because basically these patients already have that drug in their blood.
Yes.
Because they just take it as their normal regimen. And it's not killing them. In fact, it's helping them.
Yeah.
And even just that little bit of it in their blood is enough to kill the insects.
Yeah, so basically they're superheroes.
Yeah.
You know, they have superhero, they have super, so what is it called? Super strength,
super human.
Something. You know, their blood is toxic. So the moral of the story is make sure you know someone that is on this drug and take them on vacation with you.
Oh, yeah.
Because every single blood-sucking thing that feeds on them will die. So it's poetic justice. You know, they are superheroes.
So on the next level, and you may not know the answer to this, but what would that look like in terms of actually getting it into kind of the treatment or, you know, making it applicable? Does that mean that I have to take this drug if I'm going to travel to a tropical area, just take a small dose of it, and hopefully then if I get bitten by a mosquito, then it's going to die before it infects me? I mean, like, where do you see the next level of that?
Yeah. So this is the first step.
Yeah.
To show that it works.
Yeah.
All of the toxicology has been approved because it's an FDA approved drug. So we get to skip all of that.
Sure.
So the next thing has to be trials and preferably in people that are living endemic regions to show that it's safe, because a lot of the trials were done on people that don't live in, say, malaria-infected nations.
Yeah.
So it would be eliciting volunteers to take the drug for, I don't know how many days, we would decide, and then see how long their blood retains this mosquitocidal activity and whether or not there's any off-target effects, right. This kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what we were envisioning for using this as an ingested drug would be as a tool in the toolbox to control malaria, and not necessarily all the time, but more like an outbreak situation where you just give it to people if they want to take it, so that you end up hammering that mosquito population right away to try and stop the spread of it. But ideally, the end goal is not necessarily to feed it to people or have them take it, because it's an altruistic solution. And people seem to be a bit averse to an altruistic solution. So if I'm a malaria mosquito and I'm infected with the parasite, I'm not happy, by the way. Mm-hmm. Mosquitoes aren't happy when they're affected
they
by
like
parasites.
Like it,
so I'm just starving because I have to feed myself and now a parasite. So I'm going to go feed on you, which increases my risk of dying because I'm going to be even more persistent. So I'm going to feed on you, and if I expel that parasite in my saliva when I feed on you, I will die because your blood is toxic to me, but the parasite goes into you anyways, and you will get malaria.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not a preventative against malaria. Some people don't like that. They don't care that the mosquito dies. But in actuality, I'm saving my neighbor's life or my child's life because I'm sacrificing myself. But because people aren't so keen on that way of addressing diseases, the idea is to maybe give it to animals that the mosquitoes also feed on.
I see.
You could give it to your cattle for, again, a very short period of time, and then the mosquitoes will feed on the cow and they will die. Not the cow, the mosquito.
The mosquito will die.
So it's like having bait, poisoned bait. But we're also looking at different ways of distributing it. So you heard me say that they only die when they take a blood meal. But we could feed them sugar that has nitisinone in it, that also has a protein in it that mimics blood, so that when the mosquito feeds on that, thinking they're getting a sugar meal, they're going to die. So it's that way not involving a living creature at all. It's just a sugar bait that's hanging in your house. And then the other way we've shown that it's working is if you coat a surface with nitisinone, like just dry it down on glass is what we've done so far, the mosquito walks along it, then takes a blood meal, it dies. Or if it's already taken a blood meal, it's filled, it's crawling along the surface, very full, and the surface just happens to be covered with nitisinone. It's like the idea of an abed net, you know, the insecticide impregnated bed nets. So it will die.
That's a really great solution.
So there's there's many different ways this drug can be used, which is phenomenal. So we're pursuing all of these angles. But right now, the big thing is that if it's ingested by a human, it works.
That's really incredible. And just for listeners to remember, when we're repurposing these drugs, they've already been approved and safe for humans. So that really kind of shortens the timeline for
and cost
for getting these things out into the market. Yeah. So I know sometimes there can be confusion about like, well, how are we just reusing this drug? Is it still safe? And and it's already gone through those really difficult and lengthy processes to be approved, to be used. And just because you're using it for something different doesn't mean that those tests are now invalid. So I think people can sometimes get a little nervous or confused about what this kind of means for, it can be confusing, I guess. So
I agree. They've already kind of gone through a bunch of hurdles. Because most drugs, when you're trying to test them to see if they work, you know, they might work in the lab, in a lab setting on cells or bacteria or insects or enzymes. But then you go and try them in people. Most drugs fail before anything even starts. And so
we
know that these drugs that are pre-approved have already passed those very initial hurdles. Like you said, the cost of these initial hurdles is huge because whoever's trying to develop this will pay for the trials, will make sure that people who are enrolled in it are safe. And, you know, if they have to pull the plug, they have to pull the plug. But this has already been done with this molecule.
Which makes it so attractive.
So then you're just doing the last bit of does it work for what for the new thing that we want it to be.
It's not about you get more bang for your buck.
For sure. No, that's great.
It is great. It's a great story.
Yeah, I'm excited to read this paper. And maybe we'll add it to the show notes so that people can read it. And
It hasn't been released yet, but when it does, I'll share it.
They can read the paper and then come and listen to you talk about it and break it down a little bit more easily.
Excellent.
So, very good.
Well, let's see. What would be the ideal way to eliminate or eradicate the sleeping sickness, which is carried by the tsetse flies, right, without disrupting the ecosystem? Because you're talking about, you know, killing mosquitoes or killing tsetse flies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea has been put forth, let's just kill all mosquitoes and then the world will be a better place.
Wrong.
But obviously that's not correct, right?
No.
Because they're a huge protein source for a lot of things that eat them.
Yeah.
They're a big part of the ecosystem. So how do we balance that? That's a kind of a big question, I think. How do we balance that, you know, these mosquito killing drugs or these tsetse killing drugs, mm-hmm. like the drug you're talking about, mm-hmm. Tisinone. And you mentioned, like, let's just use it when there's an outbreak, mm-hmm. so that we can kind of call or slow down the growth of that population. But how do we really balance killing the bad guys who are reluctantly bad guys without disrupting the ecosystem, especially in places that are already suffering from these global changes due to climate change?
Yeah. The answer is, it's a different answer, depending on the species that you want to target. So with tsetse flies, they spread a disease called, brace yourself, mm-hmm. Trypanosomiasis. Oh, you did it well.
Yes.
Meg, come on. Trypanosomiasis. Oh, brilliant. It's sleeping sickness in humans, but it's called nagana in animals. So it also kills livestock and wildlife, which is a big thing in sub-Saharan Africa, if you're talking about safaris. So it is a disease that is somewhat under control in humans. It's been eliminated in many countries before. It used to be horrendous. And they did that through treating people that have the disease,
mm-hmm.
and also vector control, which means eliminating the tsetse fly. And they're doing that right now in areas where this disease is still prevalent by putting out tiny targets. And they have these very cool targets created by a team at LSTM, at Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, mm-hmm. under the guidance of Steve Torr. And it's just this tiny little trap that's blue and black, and you put it along the rivers, if it's a riverine species of fly, or in the savannah, or wherever, and they're attracted to it, they hit it, and the trap is covered with insecticide. So they die. So it's quite targeted to tsetse flies. That is having a profound effect on the disease prevalence. So the disease in humans is being controlled. And the main thing is surveillance now. You can't just let it lapse because flies come in from different areas that are not controlled.
Right.
And there's always like reservoirs of people or animals that have infections. So you could end up with another epidemic of it. But if you keep it under control by surveillance, I think that's the best way. With the animal story, it's different because it's not under surveillance or treated as well, and there are drugs on the market that are counterfeit, mm-hmm. or heavily spiked with useless components. So you think that you're treating your animal, and what you're doing is, because it's a sublethal dose, raising resistance to the, to the real mm-hmm. thing for treatment.
Yeah. So you're making things even worse.
You are creating a nightmare.
Yeah.
So you have that, and then with animals, you also have not just tsetse spreading the disease. So you have things like horse flies, deer flies, that's the equivalent, that take a bite from you, that you're mm-hmm. infected. It's in my mouth, but I didn't get a good meal from you. You disrupted me with your tail.
Sure.
So then I'm going to bite Maggie. Uh-huh. And when I bite you, I'm dispelling what's in my mouth into you. And now I've mechanically transferred that parasite to you both, which is not tsetse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So doing tsetse fly control might not be as efficacious as like other ways. So it's a complicated story. And mainly it boils down to keep an eye on what is happening, treat your herds if you can, get a vet involved with that. But a lot of this is happening in rural parts of sub-Saharan Africa, which is a hard task. Talk about field work.
Sure, yeah.
You know, you want to go in and treat your cattle herd and you can't get in because the roads are now soup.
Yeah.
So you will lose some to the disease, and yeah, it has a very strong economic burden on people.
Yeah.
And counterfeit drugs are a huge global problem, everywhere. Not just in this issue, but in, you know, just everywhere.
Antibiotics,
you know, kind of basically cheated.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, just for our lovely listeners here, this sublethal dose that you talked about, this is not enough to kill the bug.
Yeah.
And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's so true.
And so, like you said, we're contributing to resistance. And that's a bigger problem. So now the things that used to work don't work anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That makes me sad.
Yeah, but it's a reality.
Yeah, I know several people that I've worked with over the years who now have gone on to work in some of these places where counterfeit drugs or these sublethal doses are really prominent to help develop testing that's really, you know, effective and simple in some of these harder to get to areas, and making sure that people have, you know, we were talking about sleeping sickness and tsetse flies and stuff, which is under control in humans, but so many other things, even really simple things that we take for granted in the United States, can be really detrimental in some of these areas. And then you can't get the medicine you need. You can just walk up and just buy an antibiotic from somebody with no way of knowing what's actually in there. And I remember learning that, and I was kind of shocked that you can just get this kind of stuff. And not only does it not help the person who needs help, but then it can continue to create so many problems. And specifically, people I know work in antibiotics, and we have the antibiotic resistance crisis, which is part of this is contributing to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my field, it's the insecticide resistance crisis.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's one of the good things about nitisinone, because how it kills and the pathway it targets is very different than how the mosquito learns to be resistant to insecticides like deltamethrin and all these things. So what we show is that insecticide-resistant mosquitoes die very well with nitisinone. I'm so happy about death. This sounds so morbid. Die. I like mosquitoes, really. But it's fantastic because it's providing an alternative solution in a situation that's already dangerous with insecticide-resistant or drug resistance. It's another tool in the toolbox.
Yeah. And, you know, I know people can be really skeptical of drugs here in the United States, even, and how do we know these things are safe, just like we were talking about with repurposing drugs. But then compared to so many other places, historically in the United States, we have had really rigorous, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Regulation,
like goalposts of like, this is what the requirement for something to be safe.
Right.
So, I mean, I can understand why people can be afraid of these drugs and not sure, because so much goes into it that unless you're the one doing it, can be difficult to understand. But historically in the United States, we have had excellent control over how things are produced, and we don't really have these accidents happen where, oops, we approved something that's not safe, or, you know, we have bad batches of things.
Yeah, it's very rare. It is extremely rare. And it's the regulation on both ends. So the production and the distribution. So the production of the, you know, we have these things called GMP, good manufacturing
practices.
And those are extremely important in, you know, monitoring what actually gets made at the factory. And that's even after all the FDA testing of saying, is it actually effective? Is it toxic? Can we balance the risk with the benefit? And then there's the manufacturing part, the formulation. All of that goes under testing as well. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, something that you mentioned is the dispensing of it. You know, I grew up in Egypt, and you could just go to a pharmacy and say, I'm sick, can you give me some antibiotics, and just self-medicate.
Oh,
yeah. And there's a little bit more regulations now on that, but, you know, it's Wild West, right? We don't have that here. And I think that the legal structure that we have in terms of, you know, if you harm someone, you are going to be in big, big trouble. That really keeps everyone in check, right? Regardless of what their intentions are. They're afraid of the consequences. because they're not just going to say, oh, yeah, you are a patient, you feel bad, here's some antibiotics because you wanted antibiotics. They have to be prescribed by a doctor, mm-hmm. someone who, you know, mm-hmm. is going to be responsible for that. Both a doctor and a pharmacist, they're going to be responsible. And we have lawyers who will make sure that patients get compensated and so yeah. on. So the system that's in place makes sure that everything is really yeah. safe in that sense. Mm-hmm. Can't really say the same thing about
in many countries.
So on top yeah. of the accessibility issues, to going to the field when the road, like you said, turns into soup, there's also all these other factors mm-hmm. that are not found in some of those places that we would have here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. just the support, the infrastructure, every single aspect of it is a factor. Mm-hmm. No, wouldn't you say so?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people don't understand the how a drug.
Yeah. How does it
or
start?
Or an insecticide. Yeah. Like yeah. It starts in a lab like what you're doing, like just studying it in this more controlled environment in insects. And then maybe some people are studying things in mice. And that process happens at institutions like Notre Dame and other, you know, college campuses. And then that's just the very beginning. And people don't realize that that's how you get your drugs. They're not these big pharma companies that are doing most of this work. For the most part, it's kind of serendipitous discoveries, right. But then
and a lot of work,
and then a lot of work on top of that. That's yeah. the beginning, yeah.
But
this
yeah.
paper that's coming out mm-hmm. has been 5 years of wow. my life, of the team's life, yeah. of the lab's life, of collaborators. So 5 years, that's a long time.
And
just to get a paper published
yeah.
to provide evidence yes. that your idea has merit.
And all the dead bugs along the way.
All the poor mosquitoes yes. that sacrificed their lives in the yes. name of science.
Yeah. Science.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But the big thing, at least about this story, which is such a good success story, is that we worked with so many different people
mm-hmm. yeah.
and working with a person that has alkaptonuria as a co-creator
yeah.
and being involved was so rewarding.
That is wonderful.
They had a tour of insectary. They got to see that their blood was insecticidal,
yeah.
you know, this crazy superpower that you didn't know you had. It's fantastic. And that's when science really is nice, because it's beyond the paper. It's beyond
yeah.
the science, beyond the, ooh, look what you've done.
Yeah.
It's like, how can I affect your life in a better way?
And that's actually a really good point that you make, because here's a person that has struggled with this disease their whole life. And mm. then that disease actually, the treatment of this disease, like you said, makes them a superhero.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful. It's got to be really wonderful to see that.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's really nice of you to bring them into the lab mm-hmm. and to just show them what they're doing. I think this is really important to be able to have people participate in the science that
Absolutely.
Way and be part of it, instead of like, hey, we're going to take some blood and everything mm-hmm. else is a black
and
box and a mystery.
And we won't communicate anything
Nothing,
to you.
Right?
You're yeah, anonymous. I think that's what leads to a lot of the problematic things that we've seen over decades and decades. I think of Henrietta Lacks and you
distrust
know,
in general.
Distrust because mm-hmm. patients who are suffering are used for good in the end, right?
Yeah.
Good outcomes.
Yeah.
happen from those situations, but there's a better way to do science that includes the people who are directly affected by some of the research that we are doing. And it's not really that difficult to make sure that scientists and researchers are communicating with the individuals or the groups and communities that their research will inevitably benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if that benefit is not immediate, to have them in the process.
Yeah. So. I'm very grateful to be in the lab with Alvaro Acosta Serrano, who's mm-hmm. the head of this whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes this strongly. So he's created or embedded this ethos in everybody that goes through his lab, that we are a community and we're not in a silo.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so refreshing.
Yeah.
So I think that's how we've had so much reach, because we look beyond just our lab.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And it's very good. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not as obvious how that can happen, depending on what type of research you do as well. So, but I think it can be done in some capacity, no matter what you are working on,
mm-hmm.
To find the people that care and will be impacted at some point by your work. So scientists, please go find people and bring them into our world.
Yeah. Share your fun science stories.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
I think this kind of transitions nicely into some of the other stuff we want to talk about with your work with science communication and specifically science art. So here at Notre Dame, there is a new project initiative called Chromatica Scientia, which is, I'll let you kind of explain it, but it is an art and science project that you've kind of been tasked with heading up in a lot of ways, and I've been able to be a part of some of those conversations, but I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about it more, because I know this is kind of going to be launching soon as well. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to hear about it.
Thank you. Thank you for that opportunity. Yeah. So this was the brainchild that was founded 19 years ago at the University of Michigan by a visionary scientist, and I know I'm going to mess up her last name because I could just call her Deb. Deb Gumusio, maybe. I think.
Okay.
So she had this amazing idea to take images that were generated through science, usually microscopy images, and create from them something that was visually appealing to artists. So she would ask people from across the university to submit their images, scientific images usually involved in their own research, would have a panel of artists judge them for their artistic merit, and then those that would make it beyond this, like the finalists of that judging, would be produced as silk scarves or photographs to be mounted on your wall, cards, that kind of thing, as a way to reach the artistic community and showcase, wow, look at that. That looks like a Van Gogh painting. What is that? Oh, that's the mouse intestines. And we're looking at intestinal cancer. And so that's what we're looking at. Or the retina of a fruit fly. Or like, did you know that was so pretty? Of course, they've been false colored and cropped and all of this. But it's a way to see the world, at least science, very differently and in an engaging way. And then the money, she would go and sell these at state fairs. The money would go back to the young researchers and postdocs to further their own science and to allow them to travel to conferences. And so it was a really nice closed system. So when Deb retired, she was working with the College of Science dean called Santiago Schnell, and he decided when he moved to Notre Dame to bring this with him, and it was called Bioartography. And when it arrived at Notre Dame, we are in the process of expanding it to include more than just biological images. And I really want to develop it into sound, of course. You all know I'm into sound, not taste. But the sound of space, for instance, the beauty of a math equation. So it's not so biological because people see beauty in many different places. Mm-hmm. So we called it Chromatica Scientia because of all the different ways chromatica is used. It can be in mathematics, it can be in light waves, it can be visual, sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a beautiful word, and it's a Latin word, and it can be understood in many different languages. Mm-hmm. It's not just English-centric, like bioartography. So it hasn't been launched yet, but the website Bioartography is still active, and you can see some of the images there, and they are amazing. The images, many of them are also in the South Bend International Airport on the walls.
Yes.
So you can see some of them there, and you can see what I mean by Van Gogh and Monet, how beautiful these are. So it's a fun project, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it develops in the future.
Yeah, anybody traveling through the South Bend Airport should check it out. I was there about a month ago with my son. We were leaving for a soccer tournament, and they had one of the murals was about the athlete. And so we got to take I took a picture of him with there. We read about like there's images of bones and muscle and stuff. So it was really cool to see that kind of artwork in our little airport here in South Bend. Mm. And how many people come through that airport to be able to experience research in that way. And it's not so dry and bland. And I saw lots of other people. It was like 6 a.m. in the morning, but lots of other people kind of walking by and reading about it. So, really cool.
I'm excited to see where it goes. And thank you to Deb for this vision.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. She was well ahead of the time.
Oh, yeah. So the goal then in this is for graduate students and postdocs, I'm assuming, to kind of submit pieces based on their own research and art and stuff, and then kind of have them be judged and
change the review. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so used to looking at, I don't know, the feet of a tsetse fly, you know, to look at their hairs on their feet. Yeah, it's my job. It's my work. I'm fascinated by it physiologically. But I mean, I need to look at things with different eyes. Like, what would you see when you looked at it? You'd be like, oh, it's a mountain range. And what are those little things? And that's the point, because that's what starts conversation about what I'm doing, because I want to see how you're seeing the world, my world.
Right.
So this is a bridge.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited about this. And people will be able to buy prints of these images as well.
I think so, and cards, and who knows what. So it makes very nice gifts because they look beautiful, especially the silk scarves. You'd never know there was a mouse kidney around your neck.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll post it in the show notes, because I'm sure by the time this episode's out, it'll all be kind of announced and official.
That'll be fun.
I'm really excited you're the one kind of helping head this up. I think it's a...
I'm excited too, because it thrusts me into the world of artists.
Yeah.
And I get to pick artists that are going to judge their work. And I'm not looking at just painters. I'm looking at ceramicists and weavers. And, you know, it's like, oh, yay. Candy.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It will be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to it. But you're also involved in a couple of other things on campus with science and art. And there's an initiative right now going on at the University of Notre Dame. Right now, I'm saying, is spring 2025 is when we're recording this. And it's an initiative called The Beauty of Understanding. And it's a bunch of different workshops and so on. And I believe you are doing something about an elevator pitch. Is that correct?
So I don't know why it's called an elevator pitch.
So does it, why? And so tell us a little bit about what you're actually telling scientists what to do, why it's important, and if you have any tips for any scientists that are listening to this episode or conducting the interview in this episode.
Are they in the room with us
in the room with us right now? Yes.
The title of my seminar is called Tell Me, What Do You Do? Because this is a question I get all the time. And if you get this right, it will lead down an amazing path of either disbelief or just fun. But if you say, tell me what you do, and I say, I'm a professor at Notre Dame. I am a medical entomologist that works with vector-borne diseases, particularly African trypanosomiasis. What did you just take from me?
Yeah.
You're going to say, oh, that's nice.
Yep.
And keep driving if you're my taxi driver.
Yeah.
What was, wow, I blew that moment, you know?
That's it.
But if I said, I work with bugs.
Yeah.
Bugs that spread diseases.
Yeah.
Right away, I'll have somebody, oh, yeah, you know, I got a bite on my ankle. Can you check this out? I'm like, whoa, I'm not a medical doctor.
Or
they'll be like, hey, I heard about this conspiracy theory.
Oh, yes. We actually had a, that. Well, you're kind of getting ahead of my question.
Okay,
here.
I can wait.
No, this is great, because there's actually, we have a question from one of our lovely listeners who says, are insects... Especially, let's say mosquitoes. Are they a government conspiracy to keep us all in check and to spread disease?
So you mean like genetically modified?
Yes, genetically modified.
That are spreading disease.
Absolutely spreading disease, yes.
So I was asked this question from my curious taxi driver earlier this year.
Wonderful.
And by the way, people, I don't take taxis all the time. I do walk to the university, but on bad weather days, I do take Lyft. So shout out to all the Lyft drivers. Thank you for all the questions. But this one particular gentleman said, you know what I think is going on is that genetically modified mosquitoes are spreading diseases for population control. And this is quite a common misconception that comes through, especially in times of Zika, you know, that whole interesting outbreak in the Americas and even reached here.
Yeah.
And I was trying to understand where this was coming from. And a lot of it comes from scientists. Again, we're bad at communicating and what we mean by genetically modified organisms and what it takes. But do you know how much time and money it would take to create a genetically modified mosquito that would outcompete wild mosquitoes?
Oh, man.
That would breed selectively with the species you want to target, that would still be able to carry the parasite or the virus that you want, that can suffer through all kinds of non-lab environments because an insectary is so perfect.
Yeah.
It'd be like taking us who live indoors all the time and throwing them into the Canadian wilderness. How well would we survive?
Yeah.
So the feasibility of that happening would be tremendous. And the cost of a government to do that would be tremendous. But that's not the argument that really matters. Why would the government bother? Because all they have to do is wait for something like a hurricane to come in and not respond.
I don't know if that's ever happened before, huh?
Yeah. So by not responding, you end up with all this water and flooding and no treatment. You have mosquitoes going, woohoo! We're on a vacation now. Yeah. Look at all this beautiful land or water to populate. There's no vector control spraying programs anymore. So it's a free-for-all. So you end up with this massive explosion of wild, hardy mosquitoes that can spread diseases quite well with no interference whatsoever and money having going into the government to do any of these fancy genetically modified organisms.
Yeah.
At all. You just don't do anything. You just step back and wait for the nature to do it themselves. That is a very smart way to go for a government to control a population.
Yeah.
Right?
Because it's basically doing nothing.
Doing nothing is the key. Like, just stand back and wait for the mosquitoes to go unchecked and spread diseases like dengue fever, malaria, chikungunya, Zika, all these things. You
so
just wait.
I'm hearing something here that it's much easier or maybe much more beneficial to try to push our government to lobby for support for doing something about these outbreaks rather than supporting the government to do whatever wild stuff that is completely unreasonable of making these wild genetically modified things that don't exist and it would take, you know, decades and maybe and an exorbitant amount of money. Where they can just do nothing. So then we should probably just urge them to do something.
Yep. No, at least here in the United States.
At least here in the United States. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
In other countries, there is value to creating, for instance, a genetically modified mosquito that can't breed.
Yeah.
You know, so you make them sterile.
Yeah.
You block out a gene in them. That's considered genetically modified. Doesn't mean you have to put in a gene, but you can take away a gene.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that they can't reproduce.
Yeah.
So you release all of these like sterile males or genetically modified males so that when they mate with a female, she can't have babies.
Yeah.
And that's a way to do population suppression as well. So those kind of things do work. Particularly on islands or very discrete populations. And I would say that in that regard, it would be worthwhile for a government to invest in that kind of vector control. But overall, and what we were chatting about in the taxi was the release of GMO mosquitoes in Florida to spread Zika. And I was like, just don't clean up after a hurricane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much more effective.
Much more effective. If you really wanted to be evil about it, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So then back to what is it that you do?
Yeah.
You know, can you give us some tips about how should we do this? You know, some of us work on some pretty obscure things.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's wonderful when you work on things that people have an idea about in their mind, like mosquitoes or, you know, diseases that are spread by mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Or in Maggie's situation, for example, you work on the bacteria that causes TB, tuberculosis, you know, the consumption, as they used to call it back in the olden days, right?
Olden days, yeah.
Well, what about the rest of us who are working on obscure things?
You find common ground.
Ooh.
So with TB, your lungs.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your lungs, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about what you do to keep your lungs healthy or compromised.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then how, if you have compromised things or you're exposed to allergens in the air, how, if you were in a different country, and you got exposed to a bacteria like TB, how different your life would be.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Right? So mm-hmm. it's all about, for me, it's listening to where the person is coming from. Mm-hmm. Usually I ask a question to find out what their concerns are. Mm-hmm. Or I just say, I'm going to Notre Dame. Can you please drop me off at the stadium? And they're like, oh, what do you do at Notre Dame? I'm like, oh, here we go. Do I have the energy to talk about this today? Oh, yeah, of course I do. Yeah, I'll find something. Yeah. And so it's all about how I introduce myself. Like I said, I'm a vector biologist working with host pathogen interaction, blah, 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 blah. You tune me out. And so I have to think, okay, what is a concern, you know, today? Oh, it's Lyme disease. So I'll be, have you ever heard of Lyme disease? I don't actually work on Lyme disease, but I work on diseases like Lyme disease. Well, at least I don't work on it right now, but I probably will be when it is known. But it's like, what's going on in your life? Open your eyes and say, oh, look at that hurricane, the tornado. Do you know what the repercussions of that is? Do you know what that just did to the poor dung beetles? And now you're talking and showcasing what you know about something that's different than what they know. And then they can feed back and tell you stuff that you didn't know that formulates your questions. So it's both ways. You see each other as a resource instead of as an enemy or someone that you just write off because they've just told you about an idea that doesn't have a lot of strength because they're missing data or because you just failed to communicate.
So I'm hearing a few things here. One is listening, obviously being an active listener.
Yes.
Understanding what the fears, what the concerns are, regardless of how ridiculous they sound. They are real concerns to the people that are voicing them. And instead of just dismissing them or trying to dismantle their argument, is really kind of listening and finding out what they want to know and where they are, what their questions are. Because if you're not going to answer a question they're interested in,
you've lost your opportunity.
Why should they listen to you in the first place? Mm-hmm. So these are really important ideas, and I think I've learned a lot today from this. This is great.
Yeah. So Shahir, what do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
oh boy. Hold on. Find the common theme here. Okay. I'm a protein engineer. Do you know what proteins are?
I'm the wrong person.
Oh, yeah, okay. yes, yeah, okay. You know, proteins are food, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're also amazing things, and they do great things for us. They help us digest our food. They help us move our muscles. They help us fight diseases. They do all kinds of things. I wrote a book about it. In fact, you should buy it.
All right.
You're on the right track.
How did I do?
You got about a six.
Oh, six. I really thought it was going to be like a four.
No, because you use two words like protein, most people heard about, because protein shakes. Engineer, they probably have a very different idea about what an engineer is compared to what you mean.
They think I drive a train.
Maybe. six. You got a six.
Okay, our six. I'll take it. Yep. All right. Constantly getting better is the goal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, I think that's really... I don't know. Being in the Midwest, I feel like people are a little bit more apt to converse. So it's kind of a little bit more.
Yeah.
I don't know. People are more likely to be curious about each other, even if it is just kind of a polite way. But I do get asked all the time, what do you do? Just to, you know, random people that you're waiting in line for or with. And it can be, even as somebody who tries to do a lot of science communication and practice it, can be a little bit difficult to be like, oh, what do I say? Like, you know, I usually just leave with, I'm a microbiologist.
Fail.
I know, but I sometimes it works because people know what that is in some way and they understand that I study bacteria. And especially during COVID, this idea of just infectious disease in general, people were really curious. Now people are a little bit more apprehensive, I think. Right. I don't research bacterial behavior anymore as much, but that was usually an easy one. I'd study how bacteria talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but say it that way. Instead of saying, I'm a microbiologist, say, I get to work with bacteria that talk to each other. Now you've got me totally intrigued. You do what?
Yeah.
Bacteria have voices?
Yeah. I know.
The stage is yours.
But like you said, sometimes you're like, I don't really want to go into that.
Yeah, especially when you finish the day and you just want to get home.
You're like, I don't want to think about anything that I do at work right now.
But then think about the science communication stuff instead. Or, oh, I run a podcast. Guess who I interviewed today?
That's true.
This crazy person that works with bugs.
And let me tell you about her baboon and poop story.
Yeah, totally. I want to flag that. Nothing to do with bugs. Just, you know, highlight that.
All right. So you have another project that you mentioned last time you were here, I believe, that you continued to spearhead about the symphony that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if there's an update you can give us or to talk a little bit more. I don't think we got to talk about it quite as much last time. I'd love to hear a little bit more about it if there's things you want to
This is update. Timely. You're asking me about this because we just submitted a grant on Monday to try and get funding to make this come to life. And I am very hopeful it will. I'm not biased at all. But it's called Symphonic Wings, A Story of Peril and Promise. And it focuses on giving the orchestra a voice with contemporary issues. It is headed by the infamous conductor, Cynthia Castorelis. And I'm kind of like the entomological backup because we're using science to give, we're using science to be a theme. Like what I've chosen is insect disappearances, extinctions, and told through the story of music. So it becomes a contemporary issue that the orchestra gets to be involved in, and the orchestra becomes a voice or a sound or a way to talk about a story that usually can be very dry and people tune out of. So it's a really nice symbiosis between her and I, and we have been able to woo two creatives to join with us. One is filmmaker Cecilia Kim, who uses video for her media, and then the other is the amazing composer John Liberatore. I'm sorry, John, I just slaughtered your last name. You're amazing. Who will compose the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be 25 minutes, and it'll be the story of six different insect species that we all know and love
mm-hmm.
and globally are relevant except for the monarchs. But mm-hmm. I think most people in the world know about the monarch migration. And it will be their story of how they thrive and play and whatever. And then how humans come along with their noises and drown out the insects and basically make them extinct. And then it'll be a blackout, like I said before. And mm-hmm. the audience is thrust into darkness. And then suddenly a firefly light or as a lone violinist will represent a cricket come to life at the end, showing that there is hope.
Mm-hmm.
So peril and promise is the story. And we're going to be working with it sounds like I've already got this all planned out, right? We're going to be working with the incredible South Bend Symphony Orchestra
mm-hmm.
and Deepak
yes.
To host the performances. We've proposed that we would be having an educational component, reaching out to students in the schools around the area and bringing them in, and I'll be creating an educational package that accompanies the orchestra performance. Mm-hmm. And then it'll all be recorded so it can be disseminated globally. And, of course, the score that's produced will go global as well.
It'll be shared, yeah.
So it can be shared with different countries representing their insects, their insect sounds, and incorporating it into kind of a global phenomenon, I hope. I want it to be my legacy. I mean, I'm excited about this paper that's coming out. It's a big paper. It'll help me scientifically. But that's not what I wanted to be known for the rest of my life. I'd much rather say, hey, she's the person that helped with Symphonic Wings. And now it's, you know,
it's
forever once you create music.
Yeah.
So I am so excited, but we all are, the whole team is.
Yeah.
So I really hope that the funders pick up on our enthusiasm with just words on a page, so dry. I wish they could say, listen to my podcast. But yes, I'm very passionate about this.
Well, this is wonderful. And I think this is such a great note to end on with the hopeful outcome of this. That we're hoping to fund this work so that it can have a global impact.
Yeah.
I really like the theme there of just having that hope at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My hope is that you will be able to think of an insect in an empathetic way.
Yeah.
You know, you actually will care that the monarchs are dying. Yeah. You know, there was just a report, and I think it was Fish and Wildlife. I think it's the Fish and Wildlife, announced in December that 99% of the Western monarchs will be dead, will be gone by 2080.
Oh my gosh.
Because so many have disappeared. So it's happening in real time. The fir trees are dying because it's too hot.
Right.
There's no resting places for the monarchs. So they're trying to grow another forest higher up the mountain, but they might not be ready in time. Farmers between here and Canada are eliminating all the milkweed. Mm-hmm. Weeds, they call them weeds, but they're necessary for the growth of the monarchs. Mm-hmm. So it's like this chance to possibly avert destruction everywhere just by bringing some awareness. Like, don't kill all your milkweeds, like keep a few alive so that monarchs have somewhere to lay their eggs so that they can make it up to Canada. So please let them go to Canada and then survive when they come back to Mexico. So it's this idea, we are not alone. We are not just our own species on this planet. We are all connected. And we should notice that and preserve what is amazing.
Yeah.
So that's the message that we want the symphony come on. Yes, we are destroying the insect populations, but there's still a chance to develop this connection with them.
Yeah, there's things we can still do as humanity to make sure that these things
avert disaster.
Yeah.
Well, Lee, thank you for being here. Congratulations again on this publication.
Thank you.
I look forward to reading it. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, hopefully,
you'll get the symphony.
You'll get this grant. You'll get this funding. I think this is a very important thing. And I think, you know, we all hope that we're remembered for something that is going to be impactful beyond the science that we do.
Absolutely.
So I think this is really some words to live by. Mm-hmm. So thank you for being here a second time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We didn't even get to chat about eating bugs.
Oh, man. Well, we're going to have you another time to talk about eating bugs.
I know. Yeah, so we were talking about baboons.
I know. I was thinking like, oh, well, if there's a time once Shahira and I aren't here, I'm like, we'll just call Lee. You can guest host and then you can talk about anything you want. So
That's wonderful idea.
That's a dangerous proposition.
Oh, it's a great proposition. You got to do dangerous things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. We will have you back again.
For sure.
To talk about eating bugs, for sure.
Excellent.
Awesome. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you, Lee. And thank you, our lovely listener, for listening to us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt. This is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.